Hey, what's up, everybody? My name's MJ, and you're listening to the MTG in Quarantine podcast. As usual, I'd like to give a quick shout-out to my local game store, Guardian Games. You can find Guardian Games on the web at ggportland.com. Today's episode of the podcast is the next in the White is Good, Actually series, where I bring my friends J-Row and Mono White Border on to talk about all things Mono White and why Mono White is unfairly treated by most of the Magic the Gathering community as a very underplayed and underwhelming color, and we have used this platform to try to explain how Mono White is actually a very good and very viable color to play in EDH. So without further ado, I'd like to reintroduce J-Row to the show.
There, I am J-Row, the Unsummoned Skull. You can find me on Twitter at coach_J_RO. Twitch at twitch.tv/unsummonedskull, where I stream Mondays through Thursdays at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And also on my my Discord channel, which is the Skull Symbol, an open and inviting community, and also an LFG area. I also recently started my own podcast, which is Quote of Arms, which is about different Magic the Gathering tribes, and it's mostly just a feel-good place.
And if the listeners of the show haven't had a chance to find your new podcast or haven't heard of it yet, where can they find that?
It's Quote of Arms on Spotify, several different other places, including Anchor.
Yep. Okay, so the topic of today's episode is going to be Mono White Jumpstart Packs. So both J-Row and I have pulled a bunch of effectively commons and uncommons, most of them which would be considered draft chaff, from our personal collections, and we tried to do so thinking about how we would build a Mono White starter jumpstart set. Obviously, jumpstart is a very, very interesting concept that Wizards developed last year during the COVID-19, or at least, and a set that was released during the COVID-19 pandemic, which unfortunately hurt its stock as far as print runs. But the concept is very sound and something we wanted to work off. So for those who aren't in the know on jumpstart, jumpstart is a 20-card pack format where you get 20 cards in a pack, and they basically fit some sort of theme. So there's like elves, walls, just a whole bunch of different creature types, different concepts, things. So each pack is built around a specific set or creature type. So we wanted to utilize today's episode to talk about how we would build personal mono white jumpstart packs utilizing some commons and uncommons that we feel give a very good introduction to the color of playing mono white. So I'm going to let J-Row talk about his cards in order, then I'm going to introduce my list, and we will wrap up the show talking about some of the things that we are looking for in these builds, as well as what we think we could potentially add later. So again, J-Row, take it away. What cards were in your mono white jumpstart list that were not basic lands?
So in my mono white jumpstart list, I was looking for 8 creatures, 4 non-creatures, and 8 lands. 8 plus 8 is 16, and then plus 4 winds up being 20. It's designed to be sort of analogous to if you stuck 2 of them together, it would be like a draft deck. So you'd wind up with 16 creatures, 8 non-creatures, and about... enough basic lands that it winds up being essentially what you would get in a draft deck. So I think 16 lands. The reason why that's important is because I use these as sort of the litmus test to see if a player is ready to draft. I want the new players, when I'm teaching somebody, to know enough about the game that they can sit down and evaluate cards out of a booster pack. So my packs are designed around being training for opening up a booster pack. that's kind of the theme, if you wanted to think of a theme for that.
Sure. Makes sense. So what cards did you decide to include in your 12?
So, start with, I have Blinding Mage. Blinding Mage is a 1/2 for a colorless and a white. You pay a white and tap it to tap down a creature. This is to show how white is able to handle bigger creatures, even though it does not necessarily produce them itself. Because when the green deck's able to make something like a 6/6 trampler, which is available at common apparently, white can say, you know what, I'm just going to tap that down every turn. I'll tr gladly trade a 6/6 for a 1/2 in terms of being able to get through. Standing Troops is 3 mana, 2 colors and a white for a 1/4 with vigilance. Vigilance can be a very important keyword because it allows you to continue attacking even when you also want to present a defense. Learning about tapping creatures, learning about having your creatures not tap, can teach a new player how to get the edge in combat. When I play, have my students play with these, they only play with the 20 cards. They don't mash them together until later. So they are only dealing with half a deck, and they only have half a life total. Because when they do the color challenges, they do them with only 10 life. It's sort of like when you're teaching somebody chess, when you just put certain pieces out there and say, okay, I want you to find a checkmate out of these random pieces. So when they have a 10 card, when they have a 10 life and a 20 card deck, it's not very long before either somebody mills or somebody goes to zero. So one of the cards that helps to reinforce why that life total is so important is Train Caracal. It's a 1/1 lifelinker, but the other decks don't necessarily have a lot of one drops. Maybe there's something like a Llanowar Elf out of the green deck. But for the most part, Train Caracal comes out early enough that you can start swinging the life totals. And when you're starting at 10 life and you're able to gain really much of anything, it really swings the way that race goes, especially later on in the game when the opponents have a more developed board than you. If you can pick up any early damage, a little bit of evasion at the end can be enough to seal the deal. Underwolves is a 1/1 first striker. So this makes it so that you have, again, the edge in combat. You notice a lot of these creatures are weak little creatures. You have a 1/4, a 1/1, another 1/1. But if you're able to stack any kind of a boost onto those creatures, it will go a long way. And there are some cards that are able to do that. Another creature that can be useful to boost is Suntail Hawk. So another 1/1 for 1 that flies. Now, the blue deck's able to pay 3 mana for a 2/2, which will eat Suntail Hawk all day long. The difference is that Suntail Hawk comes out a couple of turns earlier, and white is able to make Suntail Hawk bigger. Blue can't easily do that outside of maybe able to do things like counter spells or my signature on summons, which students never fail to undervalue. I also have Fencing Ace in there. Fencing Ace is a colorless and a white for a 1/1 double striker. Another great use of pump effects. So Fencing Ace is another really strong creature, but doesn't seem obviously strong. It takes a little bit of work to do what you need it to do. I have Thraben Inspector as a sort of introduction to card draw, sort of a delayed card draw. But Thraben Inspector shows the importance of having a defensive creature. Because for the most part, the creatures have been 1/1s for 1 or 2. So 1/1s or 1/2s. These are a lot of defensive creatures. So, how is it that you're able to get to the stuff that you need later on in the game? And that's where a Thraben Inspector comes in. There's also a little mini combo in there with the last creature, which is White Mane Lion. White Mane Lion, of course, it's an unsummon effect. I had to put it in there. It's also a flash creature, which is another advantage that White can have. It's a pseudo haste. When it enters the battlefield, return a creature you control to its owner's hand. So just like when I'm teaching blue players how to use Unsummon flexibly, White Mane Lion can be used flexibly. It can be used to declare a blocker, bounce the blocker. It can be used to protect itself if I need to. I can have it come out and return, but that's not always a great thing to do. It can be used to protect a creature that's the target of a removal spell. It can be used for a variety of different purposes in there, including to be a surprise blocker or to be a surprise attacker. There are 8 planes, so there are no non-basics in any of these. And then in terms of the non-creature spells, so are there any questions about creature spells that are in there?
No, I think it definitely covers the whole gambit of what you're looking for. A lot of very basic abilities, vigilance, lifelink, flying, first strike. And you're basically trying to go off the assumption that mono white is going to be able to get a lot of creatures out much faster, which gives it an advantage if you're able to pump your creatures over time.
Mm-hmm. So the reason why I would include, or why we're really why we're talking about this as part of like why white is undervalued, because if we look at these basic things that white can do, if we're trying to fix what a color does and the perception the color has, first thing would be to look at what it does at the common level. Because the rares should be things that magnify what the color does at the common level. Does that make sense?
Well, yeah, it makes sense that you want to be able to have a good base in your deck. So again, when you're trying to teach someone how to learn the game, you want them to understand the basic mechanics. So you're going to be going through a lot of the commons, a lot of things that most players put aside outside of limited because they are not useful in most constructed formats. But again, for a new player, again, since I have gone through this in the last couple of years, it was a concept that I never would have learned how to play Magic if I had only been given a pack of rares and, you know, you got to figure this out. I wouldn't have learned had it not just been, you know, here you have to learn the keywords, but each creature has one, maybe two max keywords. So over time, you're able to start learning, okay, this has vigilance, so I may want to attack with this. This has flying, which means I have an advantage here, first strike, et cetera, et cetera. Ooh, lifelink might be kind of nice, even if I'm blocking. So you start developing your strategies based upon these simple creatures with simple evergreen keywords.
You can also think about, from a design perspective, quite a lot of the cards aren't reinventing the wheel. There are usually like maybe 5 to 10 cards per set that do something that hasn't been seen before, but quite a lot of cards are just stapling cards together. For example, we could staple Suntail Hawk and Fencing Ace together and have a colorless white flying double striker. That's a 1/1. And that would be a card. I could see that getting printed. Maybe uncommon. If you wanted it to be a rare, maybe we start stapling another ability onto it. You put the vigilance onto it and add in the toughness. And so it becomes...
Make it a 3/3 flying vigilance lifelink or something. I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Something like that. When you start stapling these cards together, you start looking at, okay, what could cards be that might help fix what white is doing? And when you see the value of something like a Train Caracal, or when you see the value of something like a, let's say you put Standing Troops and Blinding Mage together, have we seen Vigilance on a Tapper? If we have, I don't remember, but I don't think we have.
No, I don't think so.
Can you see how that would be a really valuable card to print for white?
It would be.
Maybe make it like a 3/4 vigilance and tapper and cost 4 or 5. But that's still a card where I can evaluate how good that card would be. And I can see what that card could do in terms of allowing white to be the best at attacking like it's supposed to be. Instead of right now, green is kind of far and away the best color for attacking in Magic, especially at the commander level. Maybe you could say white has a bit of an edge in Voltron strategies.
Sure.
How often does Voltron actually win?
I don't know. My Voltron decks do fairly well. So in my play groups, I mean, white definitely has an advantage there because you have a lot of very interesting effects. Again, you did mention White Man Lion. I think the reason why my Voltron decks, or, you know, pseudo Voltron that can still win through commander damage, work well because white has a lot of those flash type effects. Again, I'm going to be looking at White Man Lion, things like Ephemerate, Cloud Shift, you know, just things that blink creatures. And that's something white and blue definitely do a lot. But again, if you're looking for specifically mono white, I think that's definitely part of the packages. If you're looking for a Voltron commander, including white, you have to include ways to be able to protect your commander. And that's where, again, Ephemerate, White Man Lion, similar things like that come in handy, because they're able to make up for some situations that you can't control.
Yep. What I'm getting at, though, is what they could be doing to help white be better in terms of commander is that they can start printing some cards that do basic white abilities, but adds a little something to them. Like putting Vigilance on a tapper. Like making a tapper that can tap multiple creatures. They have plenty of things that care about the same color. What if you had a tapper that tapped all creatures? Oh, you name a color when you tap it, and taps all creatures of that color.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if there are mass tappers. I don't recall too many of them.
There I don't may think be so. Like
one or two. But that's another way that we can look to the basic common jumpstart cards and think about, okay, how could that impact the future of white as a color? And how can we scale those abilities to the point that they're competitive with what other colors are doing?
Yeah, that's definitely a fair assumption, something that is definitely a lot different than how I built my pack. So obviously we'll get to my pack here in a few minutes. But it's just interesting how you came at this as looking at a way to be able to utilize this sort of as a stepping stone for game development, saying that mono white, we know, has these weaknesses or has some unexplored space. What if this color was utilized more to give white those abilities? So again, you did mention the creature being able to tap down more than one, potentially for some sort of activated effect or, again, mana effect. I'm not quite sure, but that would definitely allow white to blunt a lot more strategies than just, you know, being able to trade one for one with a single creature. Because usually that's best for a limited. That's best for jumpstart. But when we're looking at this over EDH, you're right. It would be nice for white to be able to have those kinds of effects where it is the color of balance in a lot of ways. And the ability to have one creature where you don't have to one for one yourself, the ability that you can start stringing together two or three for ones all of a sudden starts making white look much more appealing. I think this is what we're seeing a lot with the new Lorehold precon deck, especially, is we're starting to see things that red and white can start doing that they weren't able to do before, but also kind of sticking in the same area that they were doing before. Again, that being artifact control. So I know I'm going a little bit off the course here, but again, yeah. It's the fact, at least in my opinion, having played that deck myself, is that we're looking at something that white and red, all in that case, already do, which is you're going to be wanting to play a lot of artifacts to potentially be able to make up for the fact that you may not be able to get as many lands on the battlefield as other colors are, and you have to accept that. But you're able to get more value, squeeze more value out of the cards you're already playing than with cards that than cards you previously had access to. So I think you're right that the fact is that when we're discussing here that you want to have cards that are advancing those concepts, you don't necessarily have to completely try something absolutely new. Just maybe try to give white the same kind of advantage where you are able to start getting those two for ones, those three for ones in some cases, because then more people might start saying, hey, have you seen that new mono white card in the newest set that seems pretty good in EDH? Haven't heard a lot about that lately. And we're starting to see more of it, obviously, as we've been talking about in previous episodes. But I think that in order to change the perception of mono white, you're definitely correct in the fact that we need to just start seeing, I guess, instead of maybe one or two standout cards, just maybe if they could make a sea change where all of a sudden those white rare cards just are a little doing something a little more than they were a year or two ago, I think that would potentially increase interest across the board.
Mm-hmm. In terms of non-creatures, they only have four of them, so they gotta count, right?
Mm-hmm.
I have Chaplain's Blessing as one. It's a one mana sorcery. You gain 5 life. In a format where you only have 10 life, this is about 1.5 times your life total, or about half your life total. But it helps to teach the lesson of, okay, just how good is life gain? And you can see some games, it just makes games go longer. In other games, it can help win a race. So that's a card that's in there as sort of an experiment. How good is life gain? Just how much life do you have to gain for one mana before the card's worth it? And I believe Mono White Border had that, I think a poll for that on Twitter. He was trying to figure out how much life would you have to gain for one mana for it to be playable.
Yeah, I do remember that. And from what I remember of the answers, it kind of ranged between somewhere between like 2 to 5, I think. I mean, this is kind of where Revitalize falls under here with the 3 life there, is how much life is good. Or, I mean, again, since we're not necessarily talking about how much good is, it's hard to quantify that. But yes, it's an interesting thought experiment in just life gain in white at a low mana cost, and how much you have to be willing to pay to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in this case, if we were to scale it for commander level, that would be something like 4 mana gain 20 life. Because it's 4 times the life, so 4 times the life and 4 times the cost.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is, would that be playable?
I mean, ultimately, it depends on your strategy and what your deck's trying to do. I mean, I do subscribe to the theory that a lot of cards are good in the right build. So, I mean, the fact we want to objectively call something good or not, I think really depends on what you're trying to do.
Mm-hmm. I'm just thinking of if a card like that were to be printed in a commander set, 4 mana gain 20 life. So it wouldn't be in standard. It wouldn't be in like some of the ridiculous formats where it's doubling your life.
Okay, total. So just eternal formats only.
Yeah.
Okay.
4 mana gain 20 life.
Well,
that'd
it'd
be the quadruple Chaplain's Blessing.
Yeah, I can definitely see that being the kind of card people would automatically take out as their first pick, because unless that deck is specifically looking for life gain synergies, I can definitely see just that card getting cut as quote-unquote bad.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, but again, it's going to depend on the kind of deck, too.
I can also see the card getting its TLC with something like Alamoret's Blessing and and the new black-green creature that when you gain life deals damage, or they lose life. I mean, that sounds like a pretty nutty combo.
Yeah, it does.
For any of the enchantments to do the same thing.
Yeah, the Sanguine Bond, the Veto, Thorn of Dusk Grows, things like that, yeah, in black.
I mean, frankly, a card like that could help revitalize that that archetype.
I see what you did there.
Mm-hmm. That wasn't intentional until it was halfway out of my mouth. another card that I have in there is Pacifism.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of a given. Because there are so many variants and they're printed almost every set. So for a player to figure out how to play white, they kind of need to know how to play Pacifism properly. Yeah. And so it's key, especially if you're playing white versus white, to learn things like don't put Pacifism on Blinding Mage because it doesn't care. Put Pacifism on something like Fencing Ace that could take you out in one shot.
Mm-hmm.
Holy Strength is in there as another aura. Gives a creature +1/+2. And there are several creatures in here that can certainly take that boost. Fencing Ace loves it. Suntail Hawk with that boost winds up becoming a 2/3, which is enough to beat a 2/2 Drake.
Mm-hmm.
Train Caracal starts making a really nice swing. Standing troops becomes basically, you're not attacking me anymore. So there's a variety of different places that that can go. And so it adds a lot of play to the deck because there isn't like one best creature to put it on. Then the last non-creature is Mighty Leap. Mighty Leap is a creature +2/+2 and flying until end of turn. Mighty Leap on Fencing Ace is one of the most ridiculous openings this deck can have. But it can also be used to protect a Suntail Hawk, or to have it win a fight against a against Drake. It gives a creature flying, so really any creature now can take out the 2/2 Drake. Whereas otherwise, even the Suntail Hawk couldn't block it. Now every creature is able to block it profitably. Even Mighty Leap on Blinding Mage can do it. Because Blinding Mage is a 1/2, and it gets +2/+2, which makes it into a 3/4, which is actually a decent threat. But they do need to learn, if you Mighty Leap on Blinding Mage, you can't activate its ability and attack. That's where the Vigilance would help.
Okay, yeah, that's definitely fair.
So, what do you think of the non-creatures?
I mean, I know you really know your stuff. So, I mean, it's a very good mix of low-cost creatures that, again, have a lot of keywords and have a lot of synergy with each other. You've already outlined how each of your non-creature spells effectively is curated to help with four or five different creatures in their own way. And you're challenging your students to be able to start figuring out what potentially is the most optimal play at any given time during the game. You're forcing them to plan one or two turns ahead, which, again, when we get to EDH, is basically how I've learned how to become a better player. Specifically, is because I'm starting to plan my moves ahead of time, but also keeping interaction available, keeping mana up whenever I need to, in order to make sure that I have the ability to do a combat trick if I have to, or I have another way to be able to cast another creature if I need to be able to get another point of damage in. It's just, it's that, as you said with the chess analogy, is you have to start thinking ahead with your creatures. And the fact that you're given an early advantage means you're able to get some points of damage in on your opponents early. It's then you have to try to sustain that effort throughout the whole game where it starts becoming challenging. As they come online, as you now, you just have a whole bunch of very small creatures who now need to be pumped in order to finish the fight effectively.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the key part of this is learning what a win looks like for you. Because the way that you play these cards is going to be different from how I play them. So that's where you start to learn, okay, I really like loading up on Fencing Ace. And so I'm going to play defensively until I can get the ace out there. And then protect it with anything and everything I can to try to one-shot them.
Mm-hmm.
You could play, I'm trying to answer the threats my opponents have and slowly develop the board and generate advantage until I'm able to attack profitably. That would be kind of the MJ way. Mm-hmm. So there's different ways to take these cards.
Yeah, that's definitely fair. And I, again, as you just mentioned, you and I would definitely play this deck a lot differently. Even though it's something you built, I know for a fact that I would look at it a little bit differently. I might load up on the Suntail Hawk, for instance, just because it has mm-hmm. a flyer, and just because it has flying. And if my opponents don't necessarily have a flyer, well, all of a sudden, if I can slap a Holy Strength on there, you know, that's 2-3 points of damage every turn. You're able to eventually put a clock on your opponent unless they're able to answer it. So yeah, I really think you put together a very, very thoughtful list there, and I can definitely see how students would see white as a very interesting color, but it's still challenging in its own way because you really have to figure out the conduit there, how you want to play. There isn't just one giant beater that you're trying to get to and everything else feeds into that.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Okay. So we're going to move on to my list here. I kind of cheated. I picked 13 cards here. So, I mean, again, you can kind of take this what you will. We probably play 12 of them in a jumpstart pack plus the 8 basic lands, as J.R. mentioned. But again, I couldn't really get down to 12, so I chose 13 instead. You know, lucky number 13 there. So what I started off with was the Law Rune Enforcer. I liked your idea of your mage. And again, Law Rune Enforcer is a 1/2 human soldier, costs a white, and has an ability for one and tap to tap target creature with converted mana cost 2 or greater. Again, this is not going to help against tokens, but the concept of white being able to tap things down was definitely high in my mind. Obviously, most creatures you're going to be playing, especially in EDH, have a mana cost or a mana value these days of 2 or higher, and the ability to be able to tap something down at instant speed with your Rune Enforcer is not to be underestimated in any situation. It's going to be have a lot of utility. The next card...
Absolutely. So I like that you chose that it was just bigger creatures, because it's a different design area, and that is also cool to see in terms of scaling. I chose the universal one because there's a creature with Death Touch in the black deck.
Mm-hmm.
There are going to be large and small creatures that it needs to sort of duck around. So I chose one that was more universal because of the meta that I have, or that with between my different decks.
But again, I did this a lot differently because I was trying to build for a vacuum. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, and again, that's just how different we are. Is you have a whole meta that you've developed, that you've curated over time.
Mm-hmm.
And I basically just kind of picked through the box and tried to figure out what is a small... Basically, what I've curated here is kind of a sampler platter of the things I believe white does very well. That if I was teaching a new player and they said, how do you play white? These would be some of the cards that I would say, hey, you might want to give these a try because they could be potentially competitive against, you know, a similar like welcome deck. Again, some of these cards actually were from my first welcome deck because I started a couple of years ago with a mono white welcome deck. So some of these...
I'm in no way being critical.
No.
Actually, one of the cool things about having all these different functional reprints is part of how I build decks. I look for cards that... I actively search out cards that are functional reprints, because that's a way to reduce variance, just like you can with Tutors, or you could with Relentless Rats. People say, okay, doesn't Relentless Rats break a golden rule of the game that you're only allowed to have one copy? Well, there are tons of tappers. If I want to make a deck of tappers, I can, pretty easily.
Sure. And again, no offense taken. It's just interesting how we both... built these lists completely differently, completely independently of each other, but we had a lot of overlap in the ways that we were looking at what white does well and then what potentially scales up once you start getting out of the draft chaff area, once you start going up towards what most people would consider to be EDH playable.
Mm-hmm.
All right, moving on. So again, Law Rune Enforcer was in there because I wanted to highlight at least a little bit about what white does very well and the fact that it taps down a lot of creatures. So the next thing I want to do is I'm going to match your Suntail Hawk with my Healer's Hawk. Healer's Hawk is a 1/1 bird, again, for just a single white mana, and it has flying and lifelink. I wanted to introduce this to the deck, obviously, because flying is extremely important. There's a couple of flying creatures in this deck, and I feel like white has an advantage in the low-cost flyer department with things like Healer's Hawk, as well as you're able to give your players, if this was to be given to a new player, you are introducing them the lifelink mechanic in a very simple, very easy to manage, easy to understand way. You're not giving someone a 10-10 lifelinker where all of a sudden they start having to worry about large numbers here. At least Healer's Hawk is a 1/1. If it attacks, you gain 1. If it blocks, you gain 1. It's very simple. I feel like Healer's Hawk is one of those things where it's actually surprisingly EDH playable in the right builds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I used to love that when it was in Standard. I have the two effects separated because of something specific that I'm trying to test in the students, which is your ability to understand, to evaluate the importance of life gain, as well as your ability to understand of evasion. So I have them separated because they're teaching two different lessons. But it is important to also look at the value of a particular card, because that card has a lot of value. And when you have multiple keywords on a card, that should put it up an echelon in terms of how you evaluate it.
Sure. It also definitely helps that a lot of my earliest cards that I figured would work in this deck actually were from the same sets, were the Spark Guild, the Ravnica, Ravnica Allegiance, and M19 core set. So you're going to be seeing a lot of those cards in the set because, again, that's when I first started the game. and it just happened to kind of in a lot of these cards actually did influence my understanding of white. So I figured I'd bring them to the show here today and just kind of talk about some of the basic cards that I learned how to play with and how I believe they're actually. I'm going to say this, that the mono white welcome deck I was given at my local game store when I first learned how to play was extremely helpful in allowing me to just understand what white was good at and what it wasn't good at, because I was able to get a nice sampling of, you know, as you were saying, I was able to get the small 1 and 2 mana, 1/1s, 2/1s, things out there so I could understand I can get these out early. Then you had some larger creatures you could drop on turns 4 or 5, et cetera, that had more abilities. You know, your uncommons, your rares, and then just a few support cards that were thrown in there as well. So I think that that definitely had a lot to do with how I curated this list, was just from personal experience.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so again, we were just talking about life gain. I wanted to actually hit on the next life gain card that I had in here, and that card is Dwarven Priest. I figure that with white, we're going to be trying to build a large army of creatures. So Dwarven Priest is a 2/4 dwarf cleric, costs 3 and a white, and reads, when Dwarven Priest enters the battlefield, you gain 1 life for each creature you control. And again, I've tried to curate a list of fairly low mana costs for all things considered, so if you're able to drop this on turn 4, let's say, you could either have 2, 3, maybe 4 creatures, depending on mana cost and whatnot, on the battlefield already. I figure Dwarven Priest at least gives you more life than Healer's Hawk does, but it comes in one spurt, as well as it gives you a fairly rugged 2/4 body, which can be useful in the mid to late game, especially once your opponents, if we're talking about comparable decks in the other colors, are starting to stabilize and have larger creatures. Something with 4 toughness is going to be a lot better than, let's say, the Healer's Hawk, which is still going to be a 1/1 unless you pump it. Then the next section that I wanted to talk about actually contains 4 cards. And again, I wanted to cover the fact that Mono White loves to do support. When I first learned how to play Magic, I was basically told that White loves to get a lot of creatures out and support and pump those creatures. So again, I wanted to talk about 4 cards that I think actually really embody the concept of white for a beginner. And the first of these cards is Makeshift Battalion. Common out of War of the Spark, Makeshift Battalion is a 3/2 human soldier, costs 2 and a white, and reads, whenever Makeshift Battalion and at least 2 other creatures attack, put a +1/+1 counter on Makeshift Battalion. Again, this card is not overly playable in pretty much any constructive format, but I like the fact here that when you're trying to teach someone how to play, you're giving them a very difficult condition to try to meet, but also it introduces multiple ways you can try to play the game. First off, I wanted to introduce the concept of +1/+1 counters, which obviously stay on the creature. It's not just a static effect that, you know, ends at end of turn or whatnot, but also the fact that you want to, in this deck, be able to get a lot of creatures out and then be able to swing with them simultaneously in the same combat step. And Makeshift Battalion really works in that way well, because not only is it a 3/2 to begin with, but also is pumped by having other creatures on the battlefield attacking. And I feel like in the way that I built this around specifically combat, is I wanted to make sure that I had a card in here that would scale with time, that would get stronger as you go the more you attack. So again, if you can get your Healer's Hawk out there or some of the other cards I'm going to be talking about here in a sec, I feel like all of a sudden this starts becoming a 4/3/5/4. It becomes a scaling threat to your opponents, and that's what I really enjoy about it, is you want to be dropping your 1 drops or 2 drops early, getting this out on turn 3, turn 4, and all of a sudden turn your creature sideways, it gets stronger, it becomes a major threat as the game goes on, as long as you're able to keep up the attacks. Obviously, it's not always going to work, it's a potential gamble, but again, that's kind of the way I look at EDH, is that sometimes you want to live in that magical Christmas land bit, you want to try to set that goal out there that you have to try to meet. Sometimes you don't always have to play it safe. You can at least try to introduce the concept of that scaling threat versus just going with that 1/1 Healer's Hawk, which is always going to be a 1/1. This, you can at least try to make it larger if you follow the game plan that the rest of this Jumpstart pack is trying to support.
I like that it's kind of the antithesis to, I have Nantuko Husk in the black deck, which sacrifices all your other creatures to get bigger temporarily. This is a creature that wants your creatures to survive at least as long as they can, and will keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger and retain that size.
Sure.
That's a big thing in terms of the plus one counters, that at some point it becomes a creature that must be blocked. And so it enables those other creatures, which otherwise might have been suicide attacks, to get through, or at least to create serious doubt in the mind of the defensive player.
And again, in your meta that you've curated, you're potentially forcing, let's say, the blue player to all of a sudden use your unsummon effect, or use a black player to use something like Doomblade or Murder or something like that, because all of a sudden now you have a major threat on your board, but it's taking the fall in that case for your other creatures, which hopefully will eventually get through because your opponent is using their resources on this one. So yeah, it's just one of the things where I feel like it's an aggressive card that has to be used aggressively for max effect, but it also opens up avenues for your other cards to potentially hit home for those last points of damage, even if it doesn't survive. All right, so I'm going to be continuing that same concept here, and I'm going to be talking about another common. This time's from Guilds of Ravnica, and that's Blade Instructor. And Blade Instructor is a 3/1 human soldier, costs 2 and a white, and just simply has Mentor. So for those of you who don't know what Mentor is, it reads, whenever this creature attacks, put a +1/+1 counter on target attacking creature with lesser power. Again, I put this in here with Makeshift Battalion because, again, I wanted to make sure that we are going on the theme of +1/+1 counters as being an extremely powerful thing for mono white, but also because I wanted to be able to utilize this kind of in the way that I included Makeshift Battalion just a moment ago. Is the fact that all of a sudden, now if you attack with your Blade Instructor, it may not survive. But your Healer's Hawk, for instance, well, all of a sudden, it's a 1/1. If it attacks the same time Blade Instructor does, even if your Blade Instructor dies, your Healer's Hawk can all of a sudden hit for 2 damage in the air. You get 2 lifelink. You can help your Dwarven Priest all of a sudden become a 3/5. Well, now that's a fairly chunky blocker to have to deal with, or a fairly chunky attacker, excuse me, to have to deal with if you're an opponent. And I really like the flexibility of this card because, yes, you're probably going to lose it, but again, your opponent has to deal with 3 power on the board coming down turn 3. If we're talking about perfectly balanced decks here, that's still not an insignificant attack, and then you're also pumping one of your smaller creatures and making it larger, making it more of a threat, and potentially more likely to cause damage down the road. So again, a bit of a risk, especially since it only has one toughness, but I like the fact that it does have enough power that Mentor can hit several other creatures in this deck.
I also like that both of those cards were in or were essentially aligned with Boros and or Boros related abilities, and both were illustrated by Zoltan Boros.
Yeah, well, you know me and my love for Boros cards. These definitely fit a lot of the concepts, again, that I learned that you want to try to be able to support your creatures, make them larger, and use +1/+1 counters because they last longer.
Anything you can in order to be able to shift the combat, but also it's preferable to give permanent boosts as opposed to temporary ones, unless you think you can take a player out.
Sure. And again, I don't think these cards that I've chosen here are overly EDH playable. So for the listeners, we're not talking about cards you're going to be playing in a lot of EDH decks. We're mostly talking about how we're trying to get new players interested in white, and with the theory that you'd eventually be able to scale these effects up as you start adding more uncommons and rares to your deck to be able to have more lasting impacts. And that's why I wanted to include the +1/+1 counters here, because you're more likely to see that in a mono white EDH deck than worrying about this next card, which is Daybreak Charger. Daybreak Charger is a 3/1 unicorn for 1 and a white, came out of Core 2021 last year, and reads, when Daybreak Charger enters the battlefield, target creature gets +2/+0 until end of turn. And again, this is just a simple combat trick. I just figure that for a creature that with 3 power that can come down on turn 2, all of a sudden on turn 2, you're able to attack one of your opponents on turn 3 with a power 3 creature. But also the fact that, if you do have your Healer's Hawk out, let's say, all of a sudden when this thing comes down, that Healer's Hawk on turn 2 can start hitting for 3. All of a sudden you're doing 3 damage to your opponent, you're gaining 3 life. So yes, it is a one turn boost. But I think the concept here is still sound, is the fact you're able to get any of your creatures a boost. And again, that's not to be underestimated with some of your larger creatures like Dwarven Priest, where all of a sudden that's a 4/4. Your Blade Instructor is a 5/1. Makeshift Battalions is a 5/2 when you play this card. And I just like the fact that you're able to utilize this as support on the turn it comes down, and then can still be a fairly decent attacker on that next turn. It's giving you that boost on the turn it comes down, but is not necessarily a worthless creature in its own right once you turn around and you get to the next turn when it actually can attack, because it still has enough power to be able to punch through something.
It also works well with Mentor because it's able to make the creature slightly stronger than it was before. So even if the Mentor trigger wouldn't have pumped anything, now you can make it a little bit bigger so it's able to continue pumping things. So you are able to turn the temporary boost into a permanent one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's, again, that is definitely interesting just to look at how a lot of these effects are complementary, how there's a lot of symbiosis between these effects. The fact you're able to get plus one counters on creatures when they attack, and then you're also able to make your creatures larger using other creatures, it really hits, again, that point that white is meant for a lot of support. And you're supporting your creatures by playing other creatures that buff them. And that's what I really wanted to hit home with in this jumpstart pack that I built, is the fact that your creatures are going to be helping each other do various things, and then obviously you're going to have a couple other things that kind of go a little bit off. Again, the Dwarven Priest is a little different because you're gaining life, but again, I just wanted to include the concept of life gain there for that card, as well as just kind of a large body for a fairly decent mana cost. Creature number 7 is also along the same lines as Daybreak Charger, and that is Rock Charger. It's actually an uncommon from Guilds of Ravnica, but I feel like it fits with the same theme. It's a 1/3 bird, costs 2 and a white, it has flying, and whenever Rock Charger attacks, target attacking creature without flying gains flying until end of turn. Well, all of a sudden now you have not only a very useful keyword stapled to this card, but also has decent toughness, and most importantly, whenever it attacks, you can give one of your other larger creatures that is typically based on the ground flying. Well, all of a sudden now that makeshift battalion, if you can get that in Healer's Hawk attacking, well, all of a sudden it's a 4/3 flyer when Rock Charger attacks. It starts giving you that ability to be able to punch through some of the other colors. So again, if we're looking at, like with your meta there, J-Ro, is that if you had a green player or a black player or someone like that who doesn't have anything with reach potentially or they maybe just has one creature, well, all of a sudden now they have to choose what they want to have to block. You have multiple creatures that have flying, and the fact you can do this on every turn when this thing attacks means that you don't have to give up momentum. You don't have to lose your tempo. You're able to just keep attacking with whatever creatures you've been pumping through the other abilities. So again, you have the Mentor, you have Daybreak Charger, you have ways to be able to pump your other creatures. Rock Charger can help them get through.
There have been several more creatures printed with similar abilities that are flyers that grant flying to other creatures. Because flying is such a not necessarily rare ability, but such a valuable ability in my meta. That's why I have like Mighty Leap, which only does it temporarily. But yeah, I can certainly see Rock Charger putting in a lot of work and enabling some of those larger creatures to be able to continue bashing in.
Mm-hmm. And the last creature that I included in here actually was directly from that Welcome deck. I wanted to give myself one bomb, one creature that I could actually utilize to really try to break the game open and give you a finisher. So I was originally going to put the original Sarah Angel in here, but then I decided to pivot to Sarah's Guardian instead. Sarah's Guardian is a 5/5 angel, costs 4 white-white, has flying, vigilance, and gives all of your other creatures vigilance. So J-Ro, when you did mention your creatures with vigilance, how important that is to have stapled to a creature, the ability mm-hmm. to not only have a very large flying creature with vigilance attached to itself, but also one that gives all of your other creatures vigilance, effectively can help this little jumpstart pack win games, because now you have a giant threat that makes all of your other creatures better, and the fact that now they can attack, they can block for you next turn, and then attack again. So I feel like this is definitely the perfect card for, you know, just topping out the mana curve. Yes, it's expensive. Yes, it's going to be dropping on turn 6 or 7 if you get that far, and it may not always be the case, but just the fact that you have that ever-present threat in there that can do a ton of damage in one blow, as well as pumping all your other creatures, is not to be underestimated in this sort of a format.
Absolutely, and I actually have it in a commander deck. I have a commander deck that is It's a Naya color deck that that pumps creatures when they attack somebody or when they attack an opponent. So I have a lot of cards from red that force creatures to attack. I have cards in white that give my, or both green and white, that give my creatures vigilance. So I'm able to attack and maintain a defense while I force opponents to attack each other.
Mm-hmm.
It's a weird and wacky deck.
Sounds like it.
But yeah, the ability to give everything vigilance is very important in a format that is designed for multiplayer.
Yep.
It's good in single player as well, but it's so much more important when you have multiple opponents because your offensive cards need to also be defensive. That's kind of the way I've taught people about how to be aggressive in Commander. The same cards you're using to beat down need to also be able to protect you. So I have three intro decks that I use when I'm teaching people about Commander. And one of them is Danitha Capuchin, who has Lifelink. And it's a Voltron deck with it's a Cheerio Voltron deck with a zero drop and one drop equipment. So you load everything onto Danitha, and she has Lifelink, and so I believe she has both Lifelink and Vigilance. So she's a really strong offensive and defensive creature.
Yeah. Anyway, so I'm going to move on to my non-creature cards here. And I wanted to give the shout-out to my... I'll give the shout-out to my kind of 13th card that I threw in here sort of as a flex option at the very end.
I have a 13th card as well, so we can talk about it.
Sure.
I have one that I recently cut from the packs.
Sure. So I'm going to start off with, again, with the combat theme. I'm going to be talking about any kind of buffing effects. So the first thing I'm going to be talking about is Honor of the Pure, or again, we can include any kind of anthem effect, Glorious Anthem, most likely. Honor of the Pure is an enchantment. Again, this copy in my hand is from M10. It's an enchantment for one and a white, and just reads, white creatures you control get +1/+1. Again, if you want to include Glorious Anthem, you can. But again, that'll buff all your creatures. Honor of the Pure only buffs white creatures. But if you're playing in mono white, it'll save you one white mana to be able to play this for the same effect as Glorious Anthem. So if you can get this out early, all of a sudden, all of your creatures get a whole lot larger. All of a sudden, your makeshift battalion becomes a 4-3 without needing counters. All of a sudden, your healer's hawk becomes a 2-2 on its own. And then you can start adding some of the counters there through Mentor or Daybreak Charge or anything like that. So I feel like this is a very strong card for just giving your creatures that ability to try to get through where they couldn't necessarily do that themselves.
Yeah, I just got to be careful because you can't use Crusade.
Sure.
Because it was banned.
Sure, but the same kind of effect, I think, is really what we want in this deck.
I don't know. It's just Crusade's been around for so long. I'm so used to calling those Crusade effects.
Yeah.
But we can't anymore. Because it was harmful to a group of people. Anyways, so Anthems is better. So Glorious Anthems is what I usually call them now.
Mm-hmm. And speaking of Anthem effects, the next card I actually wanted to include was an instant called Inspired Charge. And Inspired Charge is an instant for 2 white-white and reads, creatures you control get +2/+1 until end of turn. Obviously, we've been talking about, in this pack specifically, talking about giving some creatures give other creatures power boosts. Well, all of a sudden, Inspired Charge just gives you a very large turbo boost in one turn. It costs a lot of mana, so again, it's a serious mana sink, but if you've already built up your army and you just need to be able to punch through, Inspired Charge is definitely the kind of card you're going to want to have in your back pocket to try to be able to finish a game. So I would consider that to be kind of a game ender, right there along with the Sarah's Guardian in this pack.
Yeah, mass pumps like that are really solid, really at instant speed. I've won plenty of games with cards like that.
Yeah, they're really nice to be able to have. And again, this is something where you can definitely have that in EDH as well. The fact to be able to effectively giant growth a bunch of your creatures, but in this time be able to give them that boost in mono white is not to be underestimated, especially when you have a very large board. The third non-creature card that I wanted to talk about today was Basri's Solidarity, a uncommon from M21, actually. And it's a sorcery for one and a white and reads, put a +1/+1 counter on each creature you control. Again, I wanted to have a minor +1/+1 counter theme in this deck, mostly to introduce players to the concepts of putting +1/+1 counters on their creatures to make them permanently stronger. And the fact that you can pump your team with this permanently versus Inspired Charge, especially at such a low mana cost, all of a sudden if you start having three or four creatures down on the battlefield, this makes them extremely scary. Even having one creature on the battlefield, you can definitely invest two mana and make it larger permanently, and it's still a very good deal, especially when you're talking about these kinds of intro decks where you're not necessarily worried about how many creatures you have on the battlefield. You're going to be able to get some value off it no matter what.
I would say it's interesting how many pump effects there are, but I mean, granted, I had a couple as well.
Yeah, I mean, when I was looking through my box, I just had a lot of interesting pump effects that I figured would go in there. But again, I think this one is different than the other two because this one provides that permanent boost. If someone blows up Honor of the Pure, all of a sudden you don't have that anymore. You know, after Inspired Charge is used, you don't have that anymore. But Basri Solidarity will still get through because you have that permanent +1/+1 counter. And again, since you had that off makeshift battalion, I just wanted to include that little sub theme in there to basically give the new players an idea of this is what you're trying to get to. You're more likely to see the +1/+1 counters is the further you go in Magic than you are to see the combat tricks outside of Limited.
Yeah, and also when they see how nice it is to have a permanent boost, that can help them evaluate things like Proliferate.
Sure.
Imagine if that permanent boost went up for everything that has the counter on it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you can definitely start introducing people to either the Selesnya starter pack or the Atraxa starter pack by going off this, I suppose.
I think it would be interesting, especially if we were to think about what other colors might look like for this pool.
Mm-hmm.
I think it'd be interesting to see, like, a black deck with Wither.
Yeah, it definitely would be. Maybe someday we'll do that for a different episode. We'll try to build a different monocolored deck for different colors. Obviously not in this series, but maybe just for general interest.
Yeah, I was just thinking about it.
I think we actually should do that. It'd just be really funny. It's like, yeah, today on White is Good Already, we're going to talk about mono-black decks. You know, haha, fooled ya.
Well, I mean, we could always frame it in such a way that we're talking about what the mono black deck does in relation to the white deck and how the mono black scales to match what's out there. For example, there are black X put X -1/-1 counters on all creatures. Mm-hmm. Is there a white X put X +1/+1 counters on all your creatures?
You know, I'm not sure.
Why does black get that but not white?
Yeah, that would actually be interesting to look at it for a future episode. We'll keep that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and the last card I wanted to cover today, at least out of my main 12, was Disenchant. Again, this is something that white does extremely well, is blowing up artifacts and enchantments. You can do this for one white and instant speed. So the fact that you can blow up someone's mana rock in EDH, or even just blow up, again, you know, if someone had a problematic enchantment, even in this very small, very low-level jumpstart pack concept, if someone has a problematic mana rock or enchantment that's really bothering you, that's stopping you from doing things, you can just blow it up for two mana at instant speed.
Yeah, especially like doing things like, yeah, you play your Thraven Inspector, and you're assuming that you're going to be able to get a draw out of it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you're on the draw, then turn two Disenchant on the clue token means, yeah, you got a 1/2, but it's not getting any bigger, and you're not getting any more value out of it.
Mm-hmm. And again, if we were to try to build similar decks to what we've put out here today, I'm sure the other decks are going to have something good in the artifact or enchantment section that you would want to blow up as the mono white player, because it's going to bother you, something that would potentially stop you from combat, or even your effect pacifism there. Well, all of a sudden, Disenchant gets you around that problem.
I will say, not in mine because I don't have a lot of artifacts and enchantments in other colors.
Sure. But I think it's more of a thought experiment because white has a lot of these sorts of effects available to it. Again, obviously, I wasn't going to put a board wipe in here because it's really, it is the exact opposite of what this deck wants to do, which is get a lot of creatures out and attack. But again, white is very good at cleaning artifacts, enchantments, and creatures off the board. And disenchant is a very valuable EDH, very EDH playable card.
Mm-hmm. But that's also where it is important to have board wipes. It's also important to be able to control the board wipe. So that's something to learn as a white player. is learning, okay, how do I wipe the board in such a way that I'm still able to attack? And also, one of the cool things about your pump effects and having especially the 4-mana instant speed one, it's not a wrath, but it kind of operates like one. Because you let them set up their blocks, and then you say, you know what, I'm blowing you out in combat.
Mm-hmm.
White is able to do some things like that, where it can build a wrath. But I would say, looking... So, if you're trying to explain to somebody, okay, how does white wrath the board, but still maintain its own? You look for things like Settle the Wreckage.
Mm-hmm.
Because that allows you to specifically board wipe an opponent. One of the cards I'd be thinking of for your build, if you wanted to think of things that weren't pump effects, but were still really good at spreading the board and showing how important that is, I might consider something like Brave the Elements.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense.
Because that gives all your white creatures protection from the color of your choice. And so that allows you to keep swinging. It also can be used as a protection effect if you want to, say, protect your big guy. It can be used defensively to swing combat in your favor. And it's a slightly different type of card. It is a little bit risky because if you do something, or if you do have auras like Holy Strength, it might make them fall off. You can also say, look at an older card like Holy Strength and then look at a more recent card and you see how the more recent card has templating that says this does not cause auras to fall off. The older card does not. So it can be a little teaching point there.
Mm-hmm. I think with that one, though, we do have to consider that if we're trying to teach someone how to play Magic, protection is a very difficult keyword, I would say, to understand. It took me a long time to understand everything, and I still don't quite know every single application for that sort of thing. So I would consider that to be one caveat to Brave the Elements, is that it is a very complicated keyword that, again, if you're just teaching someone about Magic, might be a little difficult to really get through the first time. But again, that's just me. So, and then my 13th card that I wanted to talk about here, again, kind of the flex option, I wanted to go a little bit off the beaten path here, but still also finish with the combat swing beat face concept, and that's Sworn Companions, another common from Guild of Ravnica. It's a sorcery for 2 and a white, and reads, create 2/1/1 white soldier creature tokens with lifelink. Effectively just improving your board, getting more creatures out there, giving you that lifelink sorcery speed, so again, you're forcing your player to understand the difference between sorceries and instants. But again, you're just giving them more bodies to then be able to pump with your other creatures, pump with Inspired Charge, Honor of the Pure, Makeshift Battalion, whatever, what have you, Basri Solidarity. Rinse, repeat, just get more creatures out there and beat face with them.
Yeah, I used to use it, I think, with a white-red, it didn't have the actual card, a polymorph, but it was essentially a polymorph deck. It was in Standard, and so I would use Sworn Companions to make a couple bodies and then polymorph one of the bodies into Endrist Forerunners, I believe. And it just got nutty from there.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the teaching the importance of spreading out the bodies, a very important lesson to learn, because you can get 3 mana. If you pay 3 mana for a 2/2 lifelinker, it can get dealt with an individual card. But if it's 3 mana for 2/1/1s, it's harder to deal with.
Yeah, and Raise the Alarm was also kind of on here along with Sworn Companions, because again, that's a 2-mana instant that'll give you 2 soldiers. Again, they won't have lifelink, but it's the same concept as for two or three mana, you're able to get a couple extra bodies on the battlefield that then the rest of your deck here is able to pump and make larger and become just threats. And what was your 13th card there, J-Row?
I think I put it away. Sorry. It's a 3-mana creatures you control get +2/+2.
Okay, yeah.
The reason why I took it out is because I wanted to put in Chaplain's Blessing to sort of experiment with how much life gain, how much life would you have to gain before it actually impacts things. And because Mighty Leap was Mighty Leap and Holy Strength are both pump effects, I didn't necessarily want students to learn about mass pump effects just yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather they learn about the importance of protecting their creatures and isolating some of those effects.
Sure.
but Mass Pump is also very good, and that it was kind of a tough one in there in terms of a tug of war. And I'm still not entirely convinced. Maybe I could take out Holy Strength for it, but I like Holy Strength in there because it shows a toughness boost rather than a power boost.
Yeah, it makes sense.
And I want students to be able to evaluate effectively offensive cards versus defensive cards.
Yeah, whereas my deck is effectively all attack, 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 don't worry about it. Again, just a difference in our philosophies and how we look at this color. And that's really what I think the listeners need to take away from this, is that, again, we're just talking about how we would build these lists. Again, you listening home would probably build this in a completely different way. And that's okay. That is the whole point of why we still play Magic the Gathering. That's why we're doing this podcast, is because we just enjoy this color and we can enjoy things differently.
Well, it's Righteous Charge. That's it. Could also be Guardian's Pledge. That's an instant, but sure. I chose Righteous Charge because I want them to see white operating mostly at sorcery speed, but then put in Mighty Leap.
Mm-hmm. It definitely forces those players to evaluate when to use an instant and when to hold it up.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Mighty Leap was definitely one of those cards that I was thinking about as well, just because it does provide a temporary stat boost, but also gives you flying. And since we're looking at a conceptual meta in my case here especially, but since you have a meta, you know exactly what works well since you curated it. For me, I wanted to just kind of do the smorgasbord of keywords to pretty much do the same thing, but again with an emphasis on flying, or at least being able to give your other creatures flying or other keywords. And it's just interesting how even though we may have different cards in our decks, they're pretty much doing a lot of the same things. But again, they're taking a little bit of our personalities there, that you're definitely trying to teach the absolute basics, whereas maybe I'm pushing the envelope a little more. But again, that's because I play a lot of combat-focused decks, so this is how I would teach someone who's interested in swinging a lot of creatures sideways and trying to pump them up. A whole team pump versus you're definitely trying to teach a player, you know, here's the different avenues that you can take with something like Holy Strength, but you need to figure out exactly when you're going to use that, because once it's used, you're not going to get it back. What are you going to do with it?
Yeah, I'm trying to teach them from a neutral position. So if you want to learn how to attack, this is how you can attack. If you want to learn how to defend, this is how to defend. If you want to learn how to use the cards as combos, this is how you use them as combos. Because to me, white is capable of doing any of those things as long as you use the cards in certain ways, and as long as you identify the kinds of cards your deck needs.
Mm-hmm. It's all about card evaluation, and white is no different than any other color in this case. It's just, I think that when the fact that it gets a bad rap from the EDH community especially, it's because people are not necessarily looking to do the things white does very well. Again, this is the reason why a lot of people lampoon Boros, is because they don't necessarily enjoy beating face like I do. So I look at that kind of color combination and say, you know, there's a lot here if you like combat. But again, J-Row, since I know you aren't as interested in Boros, it's because you may not necessarily have that same approach to the colors. So it just reinforces the concept that this format is extremely wide open, but that white has a lot of abilities that don't necessarily have to be based upon the combat step, that you can do a lot of 2-3 card combinations to get a lot of extra value. You can protect your creatures with flash like White Man Lion. I really enjoy that pick out of there because I really enjoy the fact that you're able to, in white, protect your creatures with an ETB trigger. It's just something that a lot of people don't necessarily know that white's capable of, but it works. I have a deck where I run White Man Lion, a card like Jeskai Barricade does the same thing, and they put in serious work in that deck versus, you know, something like Brave the Elements. Well, you know, if I only have one creature on the battlefield, Brave the Elements may not do what I need it to do. But, you know, having the ability on a creature which can then come down and, you know, keep the beat down going, in my case, that's not to be underestimated.
Yeah, it's not so much that I dislike attacking with creatures. It's that I don't like having to evaluate individual creatures and, like, say, okay, this creature goes in, this creature doesn't, because to me, they're bodies. I prefer spell slinger decks because they're closer to how I build. They're closer to what I enjoy doing. And they win in ways that I enjoy winning.
Mm-hmm.
In part because I've won with combat a bunch of times. Pretty much every time I've played Limited, I win with combat. When I'm playing Commander, I want to do something I can't do in Limited.
And you came from a combo background from your constructed play, so that was definitely a play style that you really enjoy doing. Whereas, again, I learned a very different way, and that's totally fine. We like coming at this from different angles, but we still, even though you like combo and I like combat mostly, we can still agree on a lot of the basic tenets about what we believe white does well. We have our own little quirks in there, but for the most part, I think a lot of our picks kind of go hand in hand with each other. Don't you think so?
Yes, and part of that has to do with if you want to be a good player or even a great player, you need to learn how to win with multiple different archetypes. Some people will say, oh, Craig Wesco always picks a white weenie aggro deck. I actually know Craig Wesco. I played against him at a PTQ before. Of course, he was playing Hate Bears, which was a white aggro deck. And I beat him with Storm. Because, of course, I did.
Mm-hmm.
But he has played other decks as well. But he's found something that is usually good that he can try to make better. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. But I believe any player needs to be able to play the different archetypes and try to figure out what they like about the archetype and what they don't. I've played aggro combo, mid-range control, high-level tournaments, and done well with all of them. I can play... I'm not going to say I can play aggro as well as a person who specializes in it, but I can play it pretty darn well. And I've won my share of limited tournaments, too.
Mm-hmm. And just for the record, I have built that Spellslinger deck you recommended that I build, and it didn't do overly well at my first game, but again, I'm still want to see where I can push that deck. So I'm very interested to continue trying to change my outlook on different EDH decks specifically, so that they don't necessarily have to be all based around giant creatures. I'm trying to play a lot of cantrips in that deck, which for me is very challenging. It's not the way that I really ever learned how to play. So kind of going off of what you just said is that's a very weird territory for me, but I'm excited to see where it goes.
Yeah, and we'll have to talk about that sometime. But with regards to Spellslinger decks and combo decks, it's all about the math. As weird as that'll sound, it is absolutely 100% math in terms of getting those to work. And I have a formula for it, which is why I'm able to get them to work, even though they look really nutty, like my Suicide Selenia decks, mm-hmm. How it works. So, because I have a formula for them, I'm able to get them to work and do the things that a commander deck needs to do, even though they look silly. It works, though. It does the thing I want it to do. Whether or not the thing I want it to do wins the game, sometimes it does, sometimes it doesn't. But no matter what, it will do the thing.
And in order for you to be able to get there, you have to have that innate understanding of what each color does really well to try to be able to work with those strengths while minimizing the weaknesses.
Having having a fairly deep knowledge and having played for a long time, yeah, that does help. But also identifying what the different jobs are a deck needs to do and how you can do those jobs in a unique way in that strategy. For example, I love removal effects, especially on summon effects, and one of the ones that was played last night was an effect that bounces a creature and gives each of that creature's controller's opponents a copy of the card. Well, he played it in Cody, bounced Cody, and gave each of his opponents a Cody. Cody says you can't play permanents. Used it to lock the board down.
Someone fractured identity, Cody.
Yeah.
Oh man, that's brutal.
It was awesome though.
I know, but it sounds terrible to play against.
Oh, the hilarious part was that I was playing a Spellslinger deck, so it didn't matter.
Yeah. But against me though, that would just be crippling. Unless I had a disenchant of some kind, or an unsummon effect.
Yeah, or if you had enough, I mean, you could always use the Cody to find it.
Sure.
It's still a Cody.
Yep, that's why we pack a disenchant, kids.
Yep.
You never know when you're gonna need it. All right, I think we've had a really, really good episode here, J-Ro, talking about our mono white jumpstart packs and just seeing how our packs are similar and how they differ. But again, knowing that we're trying to cover a lot of the basic concepts of what mono white does well to try to teach new players about why they should at least give white a try. I know that mono white border would definitely be remiss if we didn't try to get people to play mono white, because he's just found so many ways to, in a lot of ways, break that color that it just astounds me what he is able to do with this color, given, what people mostly say about white just being weak. He has every ability to be able to say, not so fast. Here's the crazy contraption I've come up with. Here's how it works, and here's how I'm going to kick your butt.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so where can people find you again, J-Ro, on the internet?
So you can find me at so on Twitter at coach underscore J underscore RO. I stream Mondays through Thursdays at twitch.tv backslash unsummoned skull. I have a Discord community at Skull Symbol, and I recently started my own podcast, which is Quote of Arms, and can be found on Spotify and Anchor.
And definitely make sure to check out that when you get the chance. And you can find me on Twitter at @mtnginquarantine. You can also find the back catalog of my episodes on, again, Spotify, Anchor, Google, Apple, Overcast, and now MTGcast as well. So you can find me on there as well as a lot of your favorite larger podcast episode, your favorites. So again, definitely check both of us out on Spotify, Anchor, wherever you listen to your podcast. We both make some great content. And again, it's been great having you, Jero. It's been great as always talking about Mono White or just talking in general about Magic the Gathering.
Thank you. It's an honor to talk with you too.
All right. Hey everybody, so you've been listening to the MTG in Quarantine podcast. My name's MJ. For Jero and myself, have a great rest of your day.
Bye.
Oh, and definitely brought to you by Guardian Games. You can find Guardian Games on the web at ggportland.com. Modern Horizons is coming out around the corner. It looks sweet. So definitely make sure to order your sealed products, your singles, and whatever else you need from Modern Horizons or the new D&D set from your local game store. Have a great rest of your day, everybody.